Well, how the tables have turned. We're doing things a little bit different on this episode. Amrit, welcome to the Illumination Podcast.
Thank you, Shauna. It's great to be a guest.
Now, for the listeners, we wanted to do something a little bit out of the box for us and give you an insight to Amrit and I having a good old chat about higher education, what's been going on in the past year. So, Amrit, you've been in the space now for, I'd say, over a decade. And we wanted to get your valuable insights into how this past year has evolved. You know, over on the evolution, we've certainly seen some pretty big topics emerge, and I'd love to deep dive into those a little bit.
Yeah, no secret. Let's rock and roll.
It's no secret. We're all about lifelong learning here. You know, it's pivotal to a modern student experience, but there's so many components to a lifelong learning ecosystem. And it's not the first time that higher ed leaders are seeing this type of learning structure. So I wanted to ask, as more leaders across the space look to a lifelong learning model, how do you see micro-credentialing initiatives and things like the 60-year curriculum leading the change for higher ed to move towards a more responsive approach to workforce and learner needs?
Absolutely. Well, Shauna, this is so much fun. Just for the benefit of our listeners here, we're trying to think of a kind of a special way that we'd want to close out 2023. And you know, you pitched this idea of talking a little bit about the year. Obviously, we do our year in review every year, and this was just such a fun way of being able to really reflect on where we've been and where we're going. So look, micro-credentialing is in a really interesting spot right now. I think it's historically been the purview of continuing education. We all know this. Over the past few years, though, we've seen this kind of mass proliferation of efforts designed to support agility and flexibility in credentialing. Back in 2021, we worked with UPSIA on a report focused on micro-credentialing strategy and direction. In that report, we found that, you know, about 88% of respondents said that micro-credentialing initiatives are tightly aligned with their institutional strategic plans. 71% said alternative credentials would help them achieve revenue and enrollment goals. And honestly, that orientation towards the brass tacks of what the institution needs has really seen almost a startling shift in the way that schools are approaching micro-credentialing. But the downside of that is almost this, you know, too fast, too soon approach that some schools have taken. I don't know that we're going about the growth and the scale of micro-credentialing in a way that is truly scalable. I think we're seeing a lot of individual efforts being pushed by a lot of different parts of the same institution, and it's creating confusion for, you know, for learners, for employers, for faculty, and for institutional staff. It's creating numerous overlapping offerings coming from the same place, and it's creating inconsistency in, you know, program rigor. It's creating inconsistency in even the look and the feel of the credentials that are being offered. We did a report this year with UPSIA and ACRO that looked specifically at this question of, you know, what is the gap between continuing ed and the registrar's office when it comes to micro-credentialing? And, you know, I think it was pretty clear. What we found is there's a lot of different departments within the same institution offering micro-credentialing when there's still a division oriented to CE. There's very little actual collaboration between the registrar's office and continuing ed. So anyway, long story short, I think where we are with micro-credentialing is interesting because there's a buy-in to the value of micro-credentials that I think is far surpassed what we've seen in the past. But I think there's a need to temper that excitement a little bit and to focus more on sort of quality and on the learner experience, the learner need, and how we're meeting that. To that end, you know, there's a much broader role that continuing ed divisions need to play in positioning themselves as institutional experts on the management of non-degree credentials and on the support and the management of the learners that enroll in those programs. This isn't to say that, you know, you have a siloed continuing ed division where every component of the program needs to live in CE, but I think there's a lot more space for an active collaboration between continuing ed and the main campus on creating micro-credentials that really extend the expertise of the university into audiences and into spaces that weren't previously being served.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so along with the type of, you know, curriculum that they're delivering, because obviously that has to be adapted, there are other things that need to be adapted. We all know that you can't just throw something at a wall and hope it sticks. You know, learner engagement requires strategy, and it begins with personalization. Mm-hmm. And Personalization isn't an unfamiliar topic. We see personalization everywhere in our day-to-day lives. So, when it comes to higher ed, how have you seen institutions embrace a personalized experience that learners demand? And then, are there any aspects that still require more attention or improvement?
Personalization is so interesting because it's like, to my mind, it's this very front-facing signal that as an industry, we're starting to treat our customers, our students, with a little bit of respect. I think historically in our industry, we've really focused on the student as a number. You know, the student is one of many, the student is part of a cohort, and we don't really think about their individualized needs. So when it comes to serving learners, we're thinking about them en masse. There's nowhere that that's more true, honestly, than the fact that we call non-traditional students non-traditional. Because it basically implies that there's two groups of students. There's traditional students and there's non-traditional students. And when you actually think about who makes up that non-traditional bucket of students, it's an unbelievably diverse array of students. But then when you look at the traditional bucket of students, there's also an unbelievably diverse array of individuals that live within that segment as well. So the closer we can get to actually treating students with some level of individuality, the better. So where have we seen personalization? I mean, it starts with, again, that consumer experience. I think personalizing digital experiences is something that every industry has done very well for a very long time. We're starting to see it emerge in higher ed. We're seeing more personalization on websites. I'd say, you know, creating personalized pathways for individuals that land on a website to be able to get them to one of the 70,000 pages on the institutional website that's relevant to them. That if you're just trying to click through and navigate through to the right course or the right program, that can be really confusing. Just from a web navigation perspective. So we're seeing more personalization efforts that are designed to look at someone's browsing history, look at sort of where they geographically are, and make sure that the right information, the relevant information for them is easy to find. I think we're also seeing some interesting approaches to personalization in the student affairs space, which I know we're going to talk a little bit more about student affairs later, but you know, just in terms of tracking and measuring the kind of engagement that individuals are doing on a campus and making sure that, you know, we're able to flag students that might be at risk for a dropout or might be struggling to feel a sense of belonging on campus, as indicated by their participation in campus events. I don't think that's something we ever really prioritized as an industry before. So I think we're seeing personalization starting to emerge in some really interesting ways based on the capacity we have to collect and analyze data at scale. And that scale piece is really important because I don't think there's anyone at a post-secondary institution that wants to create a campus environment that's not tailored to the learner, right? Like, no one gets up in the morning. There's a great quote from Elizabeth Rees Johnstone, who's the executive director of continuing professional learning at OISE, the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at the University of Toronto. We published this years ago, but it was a really valuable point. Basically said, you know, no one gets up in the morning and wants to do a bad job, but sometimes you're restricted by the systems and by the infrastructure that you have at your disposal to actually do the things that you want to do. In higher ed, everybody works in this industry because they're purpose-driven. You and I included. You know, we genuinely care about this stuff. We genuinely care about creating learning environments that make sense for students. It's honestly, I think we have really fun conversations. One of the reasons we wanted to do this podcast is because we have really fun conversations when we get to really sit down and talk about the things that are important. So that, you know, I think at its core, we're starting to see personalization emerging in some of these segments of the learner experience because it's possible to do it without having to rely on one person just really diving into every single student record to be able to deliver that perfect experience.
Absolutely. And I want to go behind the scenes about what you were just talking about there when it comes to
Yeah.
infrastructure and stuff like that, because, you know, those are the people who are putting things into practice. And for a while now, literally what you were just saying is that institutions have been, you know, used to serving a specific demographic,
Yeah.
you know, and for most institutions, that was that 18 to 22 year old. That isn't to say that there's other learners in, you know, the higher ed has been serving, but I would say that that was certainly the majority audience, those 18 to 22 year olds. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's fair to say that the adult learner is slowly becoming the new majority learner
Yeah, I
demographic.
think that's fair.
You know, with that in mind, as these enrollment trends continue to shift, how have you seen administration adapt to this quote unquote new demographic? And what role does collaboration play in ensuring a seamless student and, quite frankly, staff experience?
You know, this is an idea that I struggle with a little bit, if I'm honest, because, okay, I'll start with what I think is a really valuable point that was made to us in a conversation, I think, with a VP of Enrollment Management at Columbia College in Chicago, where basically what they said was a great adult learning experience is not just an adult learning experience. A great adult learning experience is a great learning experience. And the point they were trying to make is the shift from pedagogy, which is, you know, the term ped is in there. When you think about, like, you know, pediatric medicine, you're talking about the treatment of children. So pedagogy is really designed, it's learning strategies, teaching and learning strategies that are designed for children. We're talking about the shift from pedagogy to andragogy. Andragogy is really learning strategies that are designed for an adult audience, everyone. And my belief is, as we start to adopt principles and practices of teaching and learning, principles and practices of institutional administration that are more designed for adults, we're creating a campus environment that's more tailored to and better suited to everyone. We're creating less of an infantilizing environment and really more of an environment where you're treating your consumer with a level of respect. So all of that, kind of coming back to the question you asked, I think we're starting to see a broad shift in how we treat, especially sort of some of these more frontline and bureaucratic offices, where there's an orientation more toward student centricity than faculty or institution centricity. I think historically, we've really done things because the only way to do things in a scalable way was to just stick to the process and really focus in on, you know, what's the capability of the technology, and we're going to work within that. But when you think about it, and you've heard me say this before a million times, we've iterated when it comes to processes of institutional administration. We've never really innovated. We've iterated and iterated and iterated. We took processes that monks came up with in the 800s to manage the University of Bologna and just put them on the computer. But what we haven't really done is look at what the process is and say, does that make sense for the student? Right? Is this a process that actually makes sense for the learner coming through the door? I've also heard it described as an ethic of justice as opposed to an ethic of empathy, which is that, you know, the rules need to be applied equally to everyone, as opposed to we need to create an environment where individuals are able to navigate the rules. And that shift in mentality is really what starts to craft a student-centric institution. One other report that Modern Campus did with Acro, I think last year or maybe the year before, looked at this shifting role, especially focusing in on the registrar's office, and found that, you know, 27% of registrars felt that their, you know, class scheduling processes, that their infrastructure is actually student-centric. 79% of respondents said that they wanted to be focusing on student engagement. And when it came to the obstacles, 34% of registrars said their most significant obstacle that they faced was inadequate authority, and 39% said a lack of technology. And when you put all those pieces together, it starts to paint a picture of a profession in transition. Right? A lot of folks that really want to be doing their work in a different way, but are hamstrung by the sort of the policy and the process and the technology that surrounds them to execute on that vision. But at the same time, we're seeing this evolution of the registrar's office. Huh? Can you, by the way, let me finish this thought, and then I want to get back to something. But we've seen this evolution of the registrar's office to one where, you know, we're thinking primarily in terms of the student experience. We're thinking primarily in terms of a one-stop shop. And I think that that's a really promising sign of where we're going, because it's not about replicating where we've been. It's not about the tradition of the profession. I think we're starting to think more and more clearly in terms of what the learner needs from the institution, and then positioning the institution to serve that need. So that's the
Absolutely.
end of that thought. Now I want to ask you a question.
On
Are
the
you
spot.
capable of spelling the word evolution or revolution or really any word in that context properly? Because every time I do it, I'm
Absolutely not.
hitting three capital L's every single time.
No, absolutely not. And it's embarrassing to say because I have a journalism and an English degree, and you'd think I would know any better. And I was, in university, it was like ingrained in my brain how to properly spell English, whether it was American or Canadian. And I still can't get either right because of you. So
Yeah,
thank you so much for that.
you're so welcome.
Oh my God.
I honestly, I even struggle to say the word evolution in a sentence without like
Giggling.
having a little giggle. Yeah,
You
and
just want to
it
do
is
like
what it is.
a little nod there. You just want to do like a little side camera, like look to the
The
camera and be
Jim
like,
Hopper look
hey.
into the camera.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Well, clearly great minds
Sorry.
think alike here. And obviously, there's a reason that we work so well together because as we've been talking, there's been a common theme running through our conversation, which is the students. And I think you had some sort of a cheat sheet just before I was diving into this question, because, from the conversations I've had with evolution contributors and other higher ed leaders across the space, students have to be at the center. There's no doubt about it. Without it, the mission is lost and students aren't going to be served effectively. And the reality is, and you've said this earlier, because I know that we're very comfortable with saying it, but students are customers, and I don't think it has to be a dirty word in higher ed. So I'd love to know from your perspective, when it comes to prioritizing that positive learner experience through customer service, what strategies have you seen, or at least you would like to see higher ed institutions use to keep those learners engaged?
Yeah, well, let me start with a little bit of data because obviously there's an organization called Think Impact, and they looked at the college dropout rates because we're seeing just simply astronomical college dropout rates. I think something like one every three students drops out before they earn a degree, which, when you think about that in the context of taking on debt, is a really, really scary proposition. So only 28% of students who drop out of college do so because of academic disqualification. So to put that in different terms, 70% of students who drop out of school aren't doing it because they can't keep up with their studies. The top challenges that exist to persistence are financial challenges, social life challenges, mental or emotional challenges, or maintaining a work-life balance. So, when it comes to strategies that are creating interesting approaches to supporting persistence, it really starts with, shocker, understanding the learner and creating an environment that's designed for them. Because it's not that they can't do the work and it's not that they can't keep up with the studies, it's that they don't necessarily have the pieces around them that are compelling them to continue or persist in that educational process. So, I think when it comes to the immediate question, the immediate perspective of like, what are we trying to do as an institution in terms of getting someone through a 2-year or a 4-year degree program? One of the things I think is really interesting, we're seeing more automation of the scheduling process. Now that sounds big and complicated. I remember when I enrolled in college, and I know that the process is not super different for a lot of schools today. We're not going to talk about years. Not going to talk about years, but what I did is I had my catalog, like the course catalog, which is a big, I think the 1,000 or 2,000 page book. And I looked up the courses that I needed for each year of the degree program. So if I was going into my second year or whatever it was, and I had an Excel sheet and I kind of mapped out the courses and what days and times they were offered into an Excel sheet to make sure that I was registering for courses that I could take. Right, courses that would actually fit on a calendar together, and that would progress me towards my degree in a way that made sense. Now, I was what, between the ages of 18 and 21 when I was doing this, so it's not like I had a ton else going on. At the summer, so those summers, I worked at a barbecue store for most of them, and then towards the end of my college experience, I was doing sort of summer jobs with the federal government in Ottawa. But it's not like I never had time to sit down and kind of do this whole big process. And then you had a specific window when you could log into the registration system and pick your courses and whatever that, now the catalogs are digital, but I still imagine that there's a fair number of people that every time it comes to picking their courses for the next semester or for the next year, they're sitting down with that book and an Excel sheet and just trying to map out what'll actually work.
It's exactly
So,
what I did.
Yeah, what, right?
I
Like
didn't
this.
graduate too long ago, and
No,
mine,
you didn't.
instead of having a physical book, mine was just on the computer, but I had to write it down. So, and it took
Iteration.
like a
Iteration, not innovation. Like literally, this is the example, right? So what we're seeing now, though, is that level of automation. It's, software that a student can kind of punch in the degree program that they're in, what they're trying to achieve, what their personal obligations are, what their work obligations are, and the system spits out a calendar and it helps them get to graduation as fast as possible while taking into account their personal gaps. So building the right schedule for a student is a very important starting point. And again, not everyone has access to an academic advisor. Not everyone has access to an individual who can take that time to sit down with them and work through that scheduling process. And not every staff member actually has the time to do that. But if you're able to leverage technology to get 85 to 95% of students scheduled so that your staff are spending their time on the 5 to 10% of students that really need help, everybody wins. And what we found is that something like one students wind up taking 1.4 more credits per semester when they have that automated scheduling technology at their disposal than they do otherwise. Right? So that's one starting point, is just actually helping them build a schedule that makes sense to them. The other thing we were talking about a little bit earlier, creating a student affairs environment where you're actually prioritizing student affairs. I think every single institutional leader that has a budget responsibility understands how important student affairs is to supporting retention of students and the importance of retention to actually hitting your top line year-over-year revenue expectations. Right? Everyone who's watched a TV show about business knows that it's cheaper to keep a customer than it is to acquire a new one, right? This is common knowledge. But in the post-secondary space, that does require a little bit of investment, but that little bit of investment in the student experience pays off in the fact that you have that individual having a successful and engaging post-secondary experience that at minimum gets them to graduation and ideally creates such a passionate experience for that individual, something that really ingrained in them that they're willing to continue to engage with the university as alumni. Right. So I think those are kind of two things that we're seeing that are really starting to change the way that folks are engaging with their institutions, and creates an environment where the institution is really set up for their success.
Absolutely. When it comes to alumni, that circles back to your lifelong learner and someone who's passionate about their institution and wants to help and will tell people about it and all those other things. It's that one small or maybe not so small action that you're taking that is going to foster and grow and give you guys a good reputation and
100%.
want people to want to be there and support you.
Small changes make a huge difference. They truly do.
Now that we've reflected on the past year, I feel like we can like stick 2023, put it in a little box, tie it up in a bow, put it on the shelf, you know? So let's look to the future. Are there any hot topics or trends that you're seeing right now that you kind of expect to continue into 2024?
I mean, the boringest answer. Boringest, most
Most
boring.
boring.
The most boring answer I can
Putting
give
my
you is,
degree at
there
into
you
a
go.
box.
Thank you. Yeah, see, we're circling around on the benefit of the English degree. Is, I mean, it's truly AI. I think generative AI is going to have a much bigger impact on folks day to day than, but I don't know that the impact is going to be that, transformational, everyone's going to lose their job thing that people were initially freaking out about. We're starting to approach the valley of despair in the innovation curve, which is kind of the moment of the innovation curve where people start to get disillusioned with the technology. But the fact of the matter is, the prediction from the Georgetown Center for Education and the Workforce is by 2030, about 28% of paid work activities are going to be automated, right? Paid work activities, not jobs, paid work activities. So what that means is that you have four staff in almost any industry, about 30% of people's time that can be opened up by leveraging generative AI. So the question becomes, okay, what's the human specific thing that we're going to fill that 30% of time with? And I think that is where we're going to see some really, really innovative and interesting change in the post-secondary space, because now it's a question of, well, how do we create learning environments that are designed for upskilling and reskilling in that very specific segment? Beyond that, where are we grabbing upskilling and reskilling opportunities to teach people how to use generative AI? Right. So I think those are sort of two very tactical things that we'll see shift in the way that we teach and the way that our industry is affected by the changes created by generative AI. I also think our operational environments are going to change. Like we in higher education are not immune to the same industry trends that shape everything else. So we can assume that 28% of every single person in our industry's time will be opened up because of generative AI. So, you know, we'll see it integrated in really interesting ways into technologies that we use every day. So, for example, you know, can you if you have like a messaging platform, will that messaging platform adapt to the point where it's able to respond to FAQs automatically, but you know, pivot questions to staff members when more insight is needed? I think, you know, these are the kinds of things that we'll start to see shaping the way that we run the institution, that again should start to free up people's time to focus on those more human-specific things.
And I don't think it's a scary thing. I mean, it might have been when it first came out because we didn't have the research and understanding of AI that we now do, at least a little bit more. And it's exciting to see when I talk to other, evolution contributors and stuff like that, talking about AI, and they're more excited for it and diving into it. Yes, there's some precautions that you need to take, but I've seen a lot of people be excited about the efficiencies that they're going to be creating and these other, opportunities that is going to lie ahead with AI. So I think it's something to definitely lean into instead of be afraid of, because quite frankly, it's already here and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. I don't think it's a fad. I think it's just an efficiency. Like once upon a time, there weren't computers. They didn't take over the world in the sense of, they took everyone's job. They've just made our lives easier.
100%.
So
That's what people talked about Google like this,
yeah.
which, you know, yes, I remember when Google became a thing. It's not, again, neither here nor there.
You don't
But
want to throw ages out there. It's okay.
no, we're not talking about that. But it was there, people had the exact same concerns. People thought it would be the death of the library, but the library has adapted. You know, I think that's it's we'll see very, very similar shifts as we'll see industries threatened. But at the same time, we'll see some really, really creative and interesting adaptations in the way that we do things to take advantage of and leverage the technology at our disposal, as opposed to being threatened and shuttered by it.
Exactly. So in the past year, because I kind of took off the bow on the box apparently here, has anything surprised you in the past year at all?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think I've been surprised by how open folks are to discussing transformation. And that's, you know, I think one of my favorite conferences that I went to this past year, maybe there were two. So one was Upsia hosted a conference with Acro called Convergence, which was focused entirely on bringing registrars and academic affairs folks and continuing ed folks into the same room to talk about micro-credentialing strategy process. That conference sold out. There were almost there, I think there were somewhere between 800 to 1,000 people who went to that. And that's, you know, you're talking 800 to 1,000 people is a significant investment of time, of energy, of registration costs, of flight and travel costs. Because I think there is a level of interest and passion in that particular space that, again, we've not really seen before. So that was really interesting. The other one was a conference in the UK, focused on lifelong learning. And what was interesting there is that I think the UK is in this space of transformation as well, where they're starting to think very differently about the opportunity continuing education can create to helping overcome some of the budget challenges that have emerged. For many institutions over the past so since 2019, over the past whatever that is 4 years. So I think that that willingness to evolve from traditional models to more innovative or alternative models is something that's really surprised me. If you think about sort of the tenor, the focus of our publication, I'm not sure if you were here when this we had to do this. We had to turn off commenting. And we turned off commenting before Inside Higher Ed did it. We turned off commenting before The Chronicle did it. And we had to turn off commenting because there was a tendency for the comments that were submitted on the articles that we published to be so far from constructive, that it simply was not worth our time to moderate them. And again, like I think every other sort of major publication in our space eventually kind of succumbed to the same pressures. But we've always been kind of focused on those more innovative topics, on those areas that are pushing the boundary of what the institution is, who the institution serves, and how the institution serves them. So I guess it's not shocking, but it's
Nice.
really nice to see those topics get the airtime I think that they really deserve outside of the digital format.
And it's nice to see also it kind of, spreading across the institution and not just seeing all this transformation and micro credentialing, because we know that that's always a hot topic. It's not living just inside the CE division. It's kind of trickling out, and everybody's coming together a lot more, and collaboration is being embraced a lot more than, we've seen in the past. So, looking ahead again to the next year, what are you most excited about for higher education, us, anything like that?
We've got a pretty cool year coming up. So obviously right now we're in our year in review. I would encourage anyone who hasn't already downloaded the 2023 edition of the Year in Review ebook, do so. The ebook's a great sort of collection of sort of highlights. It helps to capture some of those trends that really jumped out at us as defining the year. So again, it's a fantastic resource. I'd say please do take a gander. We're again collaborating with UPSIA and CAEUS on our annual State of Continuing Education study. So very excited for that. That should be coming out in March. We're in the process. We're doing a report right now, and it'll be in collaboration with an organization called Industry Dive. And many of you will be readers of Higher Ed Dive, and they're the folks behind Higher Ed Dive. So it'll be a student survey looking at what learners actually prioritize in their experience and how that experience aligns with their decision to enroll at a certain place. So it's really starting to bring that consumer mentality of the modern learner to light. It's research I'm very excited to see come out. And I think finally, I'm really excited for folks to finally start to meet you. So you're going to be on the road a little bit. You'll be at the One EdTech Digital Credential Summit in New Orleans,
Yep, and
which, okay, jealous.
then
You'll be at the UPSIA conference in Boston. Where else are you going to be this year?
I think we're also going to ACAG, which is going to be in California. And as a Canadian, going to California, excited
In
to be
October, November, it's not so bad.
there. Exactly. Yeah. And I attended the ACAG conference in this past year, a couple of months ago, and it was such an amazing time there and so innovative, and gave you some really good insights into what other people are thinking. And quite honestly, it's so amazing to meet the people behind the emails, and everyone's like, oh my God, you're actually real. Like, you're a person. They're like, we're so used to Amrit. Where is Amrit? And I'm like, hey, we're emerging me. And yeah, I'm excited to see everyone else. And in terms of other conferences, I'm not sure what else is on my plate, but I feel like there's a couple more at the end of the year that we're going to be going to, but exciting to, get out in the space and meet people and just
Oh,
talk to everyone
absolutely.
else.
Well, sorry, I also just realized we've been throwing a lot of acronyms around. So, for the benefit of anyone who hasn't heard some of the acronyms that we've been talking about, the UPSIA is the University Professional and Continuing Education Association. CAEUS is the Canadian Association for University Continuing Education. ACRO is the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers, and ACHE is the Association for Continuing Higher Education. So, if any of these topics or subjects are of interest to you, check out those associations. Reach out directly to Shauna or I, or just to info@evolution.com. We'd be happy to direct you to any association where you feel like you might have an interest or that might have relevance to you that you haven't engaged with previously.
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing those out, because I know that we can go in our own little bubble and be like,
Yeah.
oh, there are so many acronyms in the higher ed space. What do they all actually mean?
Correct. Student centricity. We need to take it seriously.
And we'll still teach people how to, spell evolution wrong, but it is right to us.
Oh,
That's all that matters. Well, all right, that's everything that we have for you. But since you've strongly encouraged that this podcast become a food podcast, we're
yes.
putting the spotlight on you. And now you lived in Toronto for a long time, but now you also live in London, Ontario. And I'm
Yes.
gonna let you choose if someone is in Toronto or London, Ontario, to clarify, where do they need to eat?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for respecting that this is a food podcast first and foremost, and then we also talk about higher ed things. So I'm going to show love to London, Ontario. And actually, it was interesting. We were recording podcasts live in DC, and Ryan Torma from the University of Minnesota was also curious about my restaurant recommendation and said that at some point I should share it. So
Exactly.
here we go. Ryan, I hope you're listening. My recommendation is a restaurant called Pizzeria Madre here in London, Ontario. It is one of the most creative restaurants, period, that I've had the pleasure of eating at. And beyond being extremely reasonably priced, it feels like the kind of restaurant where the chef and the kitchen are just comfortable experimenting with stuff and then putting it on the menu. Like it really, really feels like what they're doing is just having fun, and then occasionally something will work out, and then they just start to sell it. So one of the things that they served a little while back was a black garlic squash ring, which, we did that thing where you order it and then the person comes by and asks you how you're enjoying it, and you kind of very sheepishly order it again. Unbelievable, just unbelievable. A squash, somewhere between an onion ring and calamari was this unbelievable dish. There's a level of creativity to the stuff that they do, which is incredible, and it's always delicious, and it's so reasonably priced. If you're in London, go to Pizzeria Madre.
I'm so excited now because technically London's not that far from me.
No, it's
And,
only 2.5 hours.
but if it's that good, then clearly it's worth the drive.
It's
It's
worth the trip.
completely
It's a
fine.
great restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. And since, I myself live in Toronto, I'm going to show the love to Toronto and throw in a little recommendation. And that is La Vecchia, which is in, there is a location in Midtown. That's the one that I always go to, which is a great Italian restaurant. I know that you've had it and it has the
Love
freshest
Rebecca.
pasta, great drinks, and the vibe is amazing there. It's such a great place to be. So La Vecchia in Midtown, highly recommend. Amrit, thanks so much for letting us pick your brain this time. And maybe we'll put you in the hot seat again in the future. Who knows?
Oh, this was a blast. Hey, thank you so much. I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to connect and just chat. This is fun. This podcast is made possible by a partnership between Modern Campus and The Evolution. The Modern Campus Engagement Platform powers solutions for non-traditional student management, web content management, catalog and curriculum management, student engagement and development, conversational text messaging, career pathways, and campus maps and virtual tours. The result? Innovative institutions can create learner-to-earner life cycle that engages modern learners for life, while providing modern administrators with the tools needed to streamline workflows and drive high efficiency. To learn more and to find out how to modernize your campus, visit moderncampus.com. That's moderncampus.com.